This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, a sabbatical program for established artists. But first, when they first came out, e-cigarettes were marketed as a safe alternative to smoking, and even as a way to help a smoker quit. But data from the Centers for Disease Control show that as of January 14th, there's been more than 2,600 hospitalizations and 60 deaths linked to vaping. The CDC updates that number on a weekly basis. Fargo Cass Public Health Tobacco Prevention Coordinator Melissa Markegaard recently spoke with Prairie Pulse host John Harris about this dangerous habit.
Melissa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why is this happening?
I think this is happening because we are, a couple doctors started to figure out what was actually going on. I think this has been happening for quite some time. We're just knowing what to look for now and letting our medical professionals know what to look for. And so they're reporting.
Yeah, but is it something being put in maybe from the black market or... Mm-hmm. There's been talks about that.
Right. Yep. So the CDC's website, they're not blaming one particular device. They're not blaming one particular thing. There are the majority of the confirmed cases of lung injury have used THC or black market THC in them. However, there are cases that report no THC use at all. So then we do have to look at what is specifically in these devices that could potentially be causing this. Some are reporting just nicotine use in their vaping device, and they also have the lung injury. And so the CDC is being very careful to point to particular devices or particular things. The CDC is suggesting no use of do not vape THC, do not vape anything from the black market or for places that you don't know where they came from. Fargo Cass Public Health is suggesting complete vaping avoidance until we actually know where these products, what specifically is causing these lung injuries.
Mm-hmm. So in your view, or the studies that out there, how dangerous and addictive is vaping?
I think it's dangerous. I think we don't know all the health consequences yet because they just haven't been around long enough. But I have a feeling that once they have been around long enough and we have studies to show what actually happens, I think we are going to see some major health issues that stem from these products.
Well, for someone who's never smoked, mm-hmm. I heard early on that vaping was an alternative to cigarettes mm-hmm. and supposed to be safer.
Right.
Is that true?
So, we look at vaping products just like any other tobacco product. Chewing is not safer than cigarettes. Vaping is not safer than cigarettes. It's an alternative to getting nicotine into your body. It's a different way of doing that. Vape companies are not allowed to say that they are they can be used for cessation. So at Fargo Cass Public Health, we say the only things that can be used for cessation safely are the things that have been approved by the FDA. And so that's patches, the gum, the lozenges. There's a nasal spray to help you quit smoking. As a cessation, it's been approved by the FDA. There are a couple medications that have been approved by the FDA to help you quit smoking or your tobacco use, so chewing as well. And so right now we're looking at how do we use those approved methods to help people quit vaping, because we do have people who want to quit vaping, but their addiction is very strong. And because of the lack of regulation with vaping, it makes it more challenging to help those people.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the dangers. Are there other health dangers that come with vaping, and are they really just related to cigarette smoking?
Mm-hmm. So I think really the largest danger that we look at right now, especially with youth, is the addiction component to nicotine, because there's nicotine in these products. There's very high levels of nicotine in these products, and so we're seeing a very strong addiction when youth start using these products.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about the companies that market this. How do they market it?
Mm-hmm. So I go into classrooms, I talk to parents, I talk to all sorts of people on a daily basis about this particular thing. And so really we look at product placement, where the products have been placed. We look at the flavors that have been used, and we talk to kids about what are the popular flavors that they have heard about compared to what are the popular flavors that parents have heard about. They're very different. They have been targeted with the ads especially on social media. They're also targeted when you look at different TV shows and YouTube and all sorts of different, the social media platforms really that youth are on. There's a significant amount of marketing. And right now, because of how much youth are using these products, really we're seeing the companies don't have to really market that much anymore. You know, specifically Juul. Juul says, we pulled down our Instagram account. That's great. People are still hashtagging Juul. There's still really free marketing for those companies on those social media platforms.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Juul a number of times, but who are the companies involved with this? And I think I understand Juul has like 70%+ of the market.
Yes. Yeah, so Juul controls 72% of the e-cigarette market, and that was as of last December. So we're a full year away from that statistic, but Juul is the main guy. Last fall, Juul was purchased, a 35% stake of Juul was purchased for $13 billion by Altria, which is a big tobacco company that also owns Marlboro cigarettes. And so really now we're looking at Juul as a e-cigarette or vaping company that is owned by Altria, which is a big tobacco company.
You brought some examples.
Yes.
I don't even recognize some of these.
No, I bet you don't.
I've got a watch and a pen here.
Right. Exactly. So really, the Juul, when I do education with parents and teachers, I show them how it looks like a regular USB. It really blends in. It becomes very discreet when you don't know what you're looking for. And then if you pull out that top part, that is the pod. So that is where the liquid nicotine is and the other chemicals that they put in that. And then when that is heated up and you inhale, then that is what's vaporized and you inhale that into your lungs.
You say heated up. Is it heated up with you, like your breath or what?
Because you charge it.
Just
so it's charged.
Charging. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's a Juul. That's the top device that people are using. And then the vaping watch, push that button and the top pops off. And then you have your vaping device right in your watch. The watch works. It tells time. It's extremely discreet because you don't see it. There are so many people who wear their Fitbits or their Apple Watches. Specifically, this one, even the band is made to look like an Apple Watch band. So if people have an Apple Watch, they know what I'm talking about because mm-hmm. this band looks just like an Apple Watch would.
Basically, you're saying it's much, much easier to be discreet about you,
yes.
with your devices.
Yep.
You got an ink pen here,
yep.
or so it
yep.
looks like.
Yep, it's an ink pen. It writes very well, actually. and you just unscrew the top, and then that becomes your vaping device. It's becoming extremely difficult for teachers, school resource officers, and parents to see any of these products. A lot of times I carry around a backpack that also has other school supplies in it. And with those school supplies, then everything really blends in because you don't see it. If you don't know what you're looking for, it's extremely hard to see what you're looking at.
Illegal for teens to participate in this.
Yes.
But this creates a situation where there's no lighter involved, there's
right.
no smoke involved,
exactly.
no significant smoke
yep.
involved.
Yep.
And so, wow. Is vaping regulated?
No. No. Vaping is not regulated. You know, they can't say that they can be used for cessation, but really that's about it. Here in North Dakota, you know, we, with the individual vape juice, we have a law where it has to have a child-proof cap on it. You know, there are a few laws that we have in North Dakota. There are a few laws that we have here in Fargo, or city ordinances that we have in Fargo and West Fargo that vape shops have to follow and that other people selling vapes have to follow. But other than that, the FDA has not stepped in to regulate as far as advertising goes, as far as nicotine content and all of that kind of stuff. None of that has been regulated.
Well, maybe back up just a moment. So what is the basic law of vaping? Does it follow cigarette smoking? I mean, it's considered a
yes.
tobacco product.
Yep. So here in North Dakota, you have to be 18 years of age or older to purchase them, just like cigarettes. They're included in our statewide smoke-free law, so they have... You cannot vape indoors. You can't vape in restaurants. You can't vape in bars. That's all illegal. You can't vape 20 feet. You have to be 20 feet or more from the doors, just like cigarettes. So here in North Dakota, wherever you can't smoke a cigarette, you also cannot vape. So that's North Dakota law. Mm-hmm. In the nation, it's 18. You have to be 18. So that doesn't mean that we don't have 18-year-olds using it, or people under the age of 18 using it. We've seen those numbers skyrocket.
Yeah. Do you think you've seen, I mean, cigarette through the years, obviously, that's, mm-hmm. that's been documented,
yep.
and teens still got to cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
Do teens have, you feel like, easier access with mm-hmm. the vaping? Or?
I do feel like teen access to vaping, it has to be pretty easy, just because of the usage that we're seeing, the numbers that we're seeing of youth using these products, the access, for whatever reason, is pretty easy. And I think a lot of that does stem from social media.
Do you have surveys regarding how many teens have actually tried vaping?
Yes. Yep. So the brand new youth risk behavior survey for North Dakota just was released earlier this week. And we've known the numbers for a few weeks. But in North Dakota in 2017, teen vaping was around 22%, 21%. And now in 2019, that has jumped to 33%. So it's been a significant jump. When you talk to teens about what they feel the numbers are, they actually guess it much higher than 33%. And I think that's because they do see it a lot. They're exposed to it all the time. And when you talk to them about social media, they see it on their social media. And I think that kind of lends to them thinking that the numbers are quite a bit higher than what they're at. But 33% is pretty significant. Cigarette smoking in North Dakota high schoolers in 2019 was at 8%. So that's a pretty significant difference.
So why is that?
I think it's because we've done a really good job of educating on cigarettes. Cigarettes, like you mentioned before, you have to light it. You have to go outside. It smells. When you talk to youth about cigarette smoking, they say, oh, gross. Ew, that stinks. You know, that's yuck. No, I would never do that. And then you talk to them about vaping, and they all have a friend who vapes. They all know the flavors that are popular. They all, it's like it's become more accepted. Mm-hmm. It's not gross. It doesn't smell bad. You know?
What are some of the flavors?
Really, when I talk to kids about flavors, in the top four always mentioned are mint and mango, which really seems odd. You know, mint and mango, why are they mentioned by youth of all people? Mint and mango are the most popular Juul pods, which really lends to, okay, Juul knows what they're doing when they're marketing. If you talk to a room full of parents and ask them what the most popular kid flavors are, they say cotton candy, bubble gum, gummy bear, that type of thing. Parents never, ever say mint and mango, ever.
You know, we talked about regulations. Mm-hmm. When do you think regulations might come into place?
Hey, your guess is as good as mine as far as when the FDA could potentially do that. You know, we've heard spring of 2020, but they've kind of switched around those years. They've gone from 2022 back to 2018. Well, that came and went, and we don't have any regulations. So we'll see. Hopefully soon.
Maybe the disconnect on flavors, but mm-hmm. what should parents do if they suspect their teen is vaping?
Mm-hmm. I think they should educate themselves, you know, take a look, go to our website, Fargo Cass Public Health. You know, if you Google Fargo Cass Public Health e-cigarettes, it brings you right to our page. We put all new information up there as soon as we get it. We have a couple of really good videos, educational, as far as what parents should look for, and then with a couple of our school resource officers and myself kind of talking about what we're seeing in the high schools and the middle schools. Really just educating and knowing what you're looking for, and then if you do see something, taking it away. When I educate teachers, I had a teacher who had seen this fall out of someone's backpack right in front of him, and he didn't know what it was. He thought it was a makeup compact, and so he gave it back to the student, and he said, never again, that's not happening, because now he knows what he's looking for. So really, that sheer education and knowing what you're looking for and making sure that you are taking those devices and products as you find them.
So should the vaping companies, you know, be accountable for the health issues, that especially these serious ones?
I think the CDC needs to do, you know, they're still looking at it. We're in the very infancy of the vaping-related lung injury to know where it's coming from, what is actually happening. And so I think we'll see some of that eventually down the road. But for right now, we don't, because it's not solid. This is what's causing it. This is what's causing it. We just have to kind of go with treating it and trying to get people to realize that there could be very significant dangers in using.
Yeah, and you say in infancy. Maybe you said this earlier. How long has vaping been around in this? Not necessarily these products, mm-hmm. these devices, but how long has vaping been?
Probably over 10 years here in the U.S. But it was very new when it first started, and really no one had seen it. And now it has just become this. Really, it was initially when it started, it was the bigger devices, mm-hmm. the heavier devices. You mentioned it's really heavy. Those types of devices. And now it has really, if you go on any vaping website where they're trying to sell the products, you will notice they use words like discreet, easy to hide, easy to conceal, which really, to me, at public health, like adults don't need to conceal it. Adults don't need to hide it. It's a legal product for adults to use. So the discreet portion of it, really, I question the marketing of the discreet words and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Where does sort of the personal responsibility fall in this aspect of vaping?
You know, I think adults are adults, and they are going to make their own decisions regardless of if it's a legal product, if it's illegal. I mean, adults make their own decisions. I think as far as youth go, it's really important for parents to understand that this could have very significant health implications. When cigarettes first came out and youth were using them, you know, I mean, we now know what the significant health implications are of that. We can't wait 4 or 5 decades to know for sure. We just have to really be very aware and very cautious of using these products.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn back to cigarettes. Mm-hmm. It seems like, of course, decades of studies and warning of the dangers has had some effect, mm-hmm. it seems like. Are less people smoking now?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Smoking is really gone down in numbers drastically. And I think, you know, I think that is obvious, you know, with the big tobacco company Altria, with them purchasing a 35% stake in Juul, in an e-cigarette company, in the most popular e-cigarette company. I think, you know, Altria sees their products not being utilized as much by youth, not being started by youth as much as they used to. And if they don't have people starting to use their products, eventually they run out of customers if no one's starting to use their product. However, they saw that as well and bought into Juul. So, you know, so because Juul has lots of customers.
Yeah.
You know.
So how are cigarette companies, tobacco companies in this respect, who are they marketing to?
You know, because of the master settlement agreement several years ago with the lawsuit of the four largest tobacco companies, their marketing is very, very, they can't do a whole lot, you know, with cigarettes and chewing tobacco. Vaping does not fall under the master settlement agreement. And so it's, you know, if you see a Juul advertisement, that doesn't fall under the master settlement agreement. The regulations for vaping products is very different than that of cigarettes and chewing tobacco.
Do you think vaping may one day fall under that?
I really wish it would. Yeah, I wish it would, because then you wouldn't see so many commercials for vaping products that really seem to target a younger generation or the younger adults. You wouldn't see some of these other things that big tobacco really isn't allowed to do with their other products, but can do with their vaping products.
Do you see studies where adults are turning to vaping instead of smoking cigarettes?
So we know that there are adults that are trying to use vapes to help them quit smoking. What we also know is that the nicotine content in some of these products is extremely high. And so if vaping doesn't help them, if they continue to vape, a lot of times they end up going back to also cigarette smoking. So then they become what we call a dual user. And then, you know, there are situations where maybe vaping isn't for them. So they go back to cigarette smoking, and now they're smoking more because they were getting a lot of nicotine with their vaping device. So it's really, you know, we don't know enough about vaping devices, and they're not regulated. And so the nicotine content in them could be very high. You could be vaping a 0 milligram vape juice, or so you think it's a 0 milligram vape juice. And studies are being done that show that those 0 milligram vape juices many times do have nicotine in them. If they have nicotine in them, they're addictive.
You know, you talked about different bans, and, you know, do you have any idea about the smoking ban, you know, what the impact has been by not smoking in buildings?
Mm-hmm. Here in North Dakota, well, yeah.
It should be nationwide,
yeah,
but here in North Dakota.
Here in North Dakota, we have one of the strongest smoke-free laws in the nation, mm-hmm. because ours does include vaping products, and we have that 20-foot rule, which not every state it has, which is wonderful. North Dakota is very proud of that. But, you know, we hear lots of anecdotal, we really like this law. Can you imagine if we didn't have this law? Can you imagine going back to having to say smoking or not in restaurants, or you know, doing all of those, or smelling like smoke after you go eat or go out and have a drink at night. That smoke-free law is extremely popular, and we do need to protect that law as much as possible.
What about how addicting cigarettes are? Can you talk just mm-hmm. a little bit about how, you know, once someone's tried them and started smoking, how addictive are they?
Mm-hmm. You know, nicotine is the addictive product. And the addictive component in all of these products, so chewing, cigarettes, vaping devices, nicotine is where the addiction lies. And I think whatever you're using, you have the potential to become addicted very quickly.
Absolutely. Well, Melissa, thanks for joining us
today. Thank you very much for having me.
That was a FargoCast Public Health Tobacco Prevention Coordinator, Melissa Markegaard, speaking with our John Harris. Prairie Pulse airs Fridays at 7:30 Central on our television service. Episodes are archived on our YouTube channel. Coming up next, a sabbatical fellowship for artists.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monroe, Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. So you have heard of the concept of a sabbatical. This happens a lot on academic properties where a professor is allowed to take a year away from work, do some research, maybe write a book, have some time to let the teaching responsibilities go so that they can reconnect in a meaningful way with the work that they do. And our guest today said, well, that is a very good idea, and I think that would work quite well for artists. So in studio with me in Fargo is Brandon LaPlante, and he is one of the co-founders of the Tired Artists Fellowship. Thanks for joining us today, Brandon.
Thank you very much, Ashley, and happy to be here.
And joining me in Bismarck is Britta Anderson. She is the other co-founder of the Tired Artists Fellowship. Britta, thank you for joining me today.
Of course, thank you.
And as you might guess, they are both longtime established artists in the state of North Dakota and region-wide as well. And also in our Bismarck studio is David Borlaug. He is the director of the Capitol Gallery, which is the fiscal host for this first year of the fellowship. David, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
So, Brandon, I'll start with you. Where did this idea come from?
Britta and I's friendship was formed around our mutual love of art and appreciation for each other's work. So naturally, we spent many a long conversation talking about our, you know, dreams and ideas of the future projects that we wanted to create and the struggles that we both face being artists in this world and the obstacles that we see day in and day out for ourselves as well as the other artists that we know and talk to. So I guess we had a lot of time to also spitball and brainstorm new innovative ideas on how to potentially solve those problems for both us and other artists, and that is where the Tired Artists Fellowship was born.
What would something like a fellowship mean? How would this program work?
Well, it would be where we raise money and we give that money to artists specifically to spend a year concentrating specifically on their creative explorations and expression through their mm-hmm. process, kind of separate from all the obstacles of external life that kind of help promote the tired artist mentality.
Right, you know? When you've got that right brain and left brain thing going on and you just, one is real taxing.
Yeah, so yeah. It's kind of freeing artists up sure. to concentrate on their creativity.
So, Britta, who is eligible for this program?
So that's the fun part on like our behalf is that there is no fee or like application process in this type of fellowship. That's the kind of part we wanted to eliminate and give artists the freedom to be open to. And instead, we are actually the curators of this. We scout for the artists that we know have a credible accountability and a really strong performance in the community, as well as, you know, and if they're in the university system, if they're just self-employed artists, emerging, all different types of levels.
Yeah. How do you think that a year like this would impact you?
I mean, if I've given this opportunity, which I hope for one day, it gives you the opportunity to just solely focus on that research portion. Not a lot of people, you know, if they don't have a background in arts per se or don't negotiate with artists on a daily basis, there's a lot of intense research that goes behind art craft. Whether it's what has, you know, formed the artistic ability or just inspired, either way. But having that year to just solely focus, work on yourself, work on your craft, work within the community, be inspired by other things that maybe you're not necessarily exposed to, without, like Brandon said, any of those external roadblocks, whether that's, you know, your 9-to-5, maybe there could be a financial situation in there since we are giving you the opportunity to do so. But I don't know, just feel like it would be very beneficial for any artist that, you know, is looking at residencies or looking at grants to be given an opportunity.
Well, let's address that, what you called the financial situation. Mm-hmm. You are looking to raise a total of $100,000 in order to give people $50,000 each. Am I getting that correct? Two different artists on sabbatical?
Yes. So it's starting with like the pilot program. We are hoping to start with us or at least one of us in order to really get down to the nitty grits of what's working, what's not working, how can we sustain another artist or a few other artists on this platform. We need to be able to take control and kind of, you know, firsthand be the guinea pigs for this. But for the financial reasons, yes, we're asking for like, we're shooting for, I should not say asking, we're shooting for 100 to 150 for within a year or for at least our first go at this. Through a variety of different ways. And that will help us save a little bit so we can take an artist out on a sabbatical and then have that turnover for the following year. So kind of just depends on how things go. Since this is such a fresh startup, we're really going all four force on that. So you know, with high hopes, but we're just really passionate about the arts in our community and in the Midwest. So we believe people feel the same way.
So how do people make donations, Brandon?
Well, right now we have been concentrating on direct involvement with people that we know and people that we're having conversations with, and they would be able to donate the money to the Capital Gallery Society by talking with David, and they can directly give a check to him or put it through one of their accounts that way. And that's currently what we're doing. We are planning on opening it up to doing other options of fundraising and like crowdfunding potentially with a GoFundMe and other options. So David might actually have some mm-hmm. good information on that.
David, why did the Capital Gallery want to act as fiscal host?
Well, first, it's a perfect fit with our mission. As you know, our previous life, we're a nonprofit, and for nearly 20 years, we operated the Lewis and Clark Center in Fort Mandan at Washburn, and in that process became immersed in the world of art. And then we made a major change 5 years ago now, where it became a state park at Washburn by design. It was always owned by the state of North Dakota. A lot of people didn't realize it, but we made that change and then changed our mission, moved to Bismarck, and opened a fine art gallery.
And, a little different.
You know, kind of the same, only different. To be honest, you know, there's a million-dollar art collection at the Interpretive Center in Washburn, now owned by the people of North Dakota, thanks to our work. Carl Bodmer, George Catlin, and then many contemporary artists as well. So it's a continuation of how we immersed ourselves with art in our previous life as cultural and historical interpretation. Well, now it's a pure play. It's all about art and culture. And really what we're doing for these two co-founders is how we started out. I realized last night thinking about this, I'm 63 years old, and I was in my 30s when I embarked upon what became our foundation. It's been half of my life. And we started out using our county historical society as the fiscal agent for 2 or 3 years before in 1995 we established ourselves as a 501c3. So we'll be celebrating our 25th anniversary next year as a nonprofit, as a bona fide 501c3. And I know that can take time, and it's good, you know, to give an entity like this some scaffolding under itself until you get to that point. Because the catch-22 is to be a 501c3, you also need a track record. And so we can be the enabler, the facilitator, to take the generosity of people who believe in this and want to make it happen. And it just flows through us. We're simply a pass-through. And then in due course, you know, Brandon and Britta can determine, okay, we're ready to take that leap and become a 501c3. Or this process could continue for a period of time. You know, it's all very fluid, as both Britta and Brandon have made clear from the outset, that feeling their way through it. But I can say, as someone who's been doing fundraising for half my life, that the early response they're getting from people is very genuine and very encouraging. So as a nonprofit, and a nonprofit with a mission statement of celebrating history, art, and culture, we're excited about it.
We're visiting with artists and co-founders of the Tired Artists Fellowship, Brandon LaPlante and Britta Anderson, and David Borlaug, director of the Capitol Gallery. And Brandon and Britta, as artists, I'm sure that you have been asked a lot of times, what is your art and what is your process? I'm going to try to do this a little differently.
Okay.
Anyway, Brandon, describe Britta's art.
Ooh, this is another approach.
I like this.
You've been doing your homework.
Except Britta's got a little lead time to think about.
Oh, yes, terrific.
She does. How would I describe Britta's art? I admire Britta's work on a very high level. I think she is quite a visionary in the art world. And I'm very happy to be founding something like this with her, because she does amazing stormscapes, water skyscapes with classical oil painting techniques that are very intriguing and entrancing. They seem to pull people in when they're looking at them, almost like they have movement to them. And not just like movement in the piece, but a lot of people have expressed while looking at the pieces while I'm around them, saying that they actually feel like the water is moving. And that's one of the things that I really love. But not only that, she does such interesting things with the world of abstract and installation work and sculpture, and adding very industrial materials into her medium, like concrete and asphalt and all sorts of different creations of her canvases. And it's just so So wonderful.
Well, Britta, you should see Brandon's eyes.
Oh, it's hard. Brandon, you want to write my next artist statement, please?
I will take that on.
All right, Britta, I'll toss you under the bus. How do you describe Brandon?
Perfect. No, those are lovely words. Thank you. Oh, let's see. How to start even with Brandon here? He's like a wizard of all sorts of weird traits. From right down from like the traditional figure drawing all the way up to the unconventional ways of working with random materials that he finds and or incorporates or reuses. It's actually just really magical. I met Brandon when he was doing a lot of his functional work that's like sculptures, furniture. I've been able to see a few drawings here and there, but I was really, really drawn to the way that he was able to manipulate objects with his hands. I'm a very tactile person, and he uses pretty much even more than I do with the materials of like concrete, stone, steel, glass, wood, and he contrasts that all together to create such a diverse range of themes with just one simple sculpture or structure. And even like, it's hard to talk about because you just want to see the images so badly. They're so beautiful. And Brandon, I hope I'm doing you justice here.
Well, very much so. Thank you very much.
It's just, he's a very eclectic man between, you know, whether it's being a visual artist, a maker, a sculptor, or even a musician. You can see all of the artistic functions that he produces in each one of his art forms. And that's what I've admired for all of these years that Brandon has, you know, been working. I've seen him in the studio, I've seen him in the workshop, and I've seen him in my garage helping me pull apart weird things of concrete and rocks and absurdity. But no, he's a fantastic artist to have in the art world.
Brandon, how hard was it to refer to yourself as an artist?
That is a really good question. I spent a very long time wrestling and struggling with that in my teens and 20s. And now it's a different thing. It's kind of an evolved identity, I guess. I struggled with it a lot because when I originally was a creative person with music and art and sculpture, it was really my own. It had nothing to do with external consumers or viewers. It was all about just the joy of being creative. And when I got a little older and started going to school and going to classes for it, the mentality of why behind it kind of changed when it came to learning the skills of how to use each different medium and technique. And then it became more about the end product and like the place where it was going to be. And then I went to college, and it really kind of made me realize the humility of where I was at as an artist. So I didn't want to emblazon myself as a titled artist because I didn't really think that I had the skill or the body of work, you know, that was a necessity to be that. And I didn't have the experience and having my stuff in shows. And over the years, I have gained a lot more experience, done a lot more travel, done a lot more work. And in my mid-20s, I kind of just accepted the fact that I am an artist and I will always be an artist. And it's no longer such a heavy title to carry for me.
Britta, was it a struggle for you?
I think it's a struggle for any person that claims to be an artist, or let alone a creative. So, I mean, Brandon's got some years on me a little bit, so he's been through a little bit more than I have in some sense. We both took very drastic, you know, different approaches to getting to where we are today. I remember, like, straight out of, you know, not straight out, going into university, I guess, I wanted to be an architect so badly. I wanted to work with those materials. I wanted to design stuff. I loved to draw. I loved to do all those things. So I was like, yeah, let's try that route. But soon realized that I'm just not linear. enough to hold down the very precise everything that it takes to be that. So I was like, well, I like to work with these materials, so let's just give, you know, painting and creating a whirl. And I, you know, kind of stuck with it. I was doing it. I was drawing on my parents' basement floor forever, getting in trouble. So kind of knew that rebellious side of me. I was supposed to be something in the creative world. It wasn't until, like, honestly, after undergraduate, when I got my bachelor's in fine arts along with art education, that this was for sure the route I wanted to take. I wanted to do anything I could to make it possible that I could be an artist, whether that meant like stable enough to be it full time or just have the luxury of being able to do it on the side and provide people like what I can do, my craft, and also advocate for those other artists in my world. I went to grad school, did the whole master's thing, cried a little bit, laughed a little bit, got angry a little bit, survived though, so that was good. And now I'm here and I just know my role as an artist is not just to create art, but also to advocate for it.
David, how can galleries advocate for artists?
Well, that's why this is such a perfect fit. Because we do that, obviously, by selling art. We're a retail art gallery, but especially through our nonprofit status, we also show art as a museum. So we're an amalgamation, a blend. But we are a strong advocate for the artists that we represent, and up to 20 or 30 of them now. And, it's things like sold a beautiful piece of Britta's a week ago at 10:30 at night, lying in bed texting. it's kind of how I operate. But we are a strong advocate for artists and the art community, and we do that on a very regional basis. I mean, our canvas, pun intended, prior was national with our historical work with Lewis and Clark and so forth, and it still is. And we're attracting great artists from all across the region, not just North Dakota, Minnesota, and so forth. And so it is an advocacy role that we play. And that doesn't necessarily mean always selling their art, but revealing their art to people. We had a gallery in Medora all summer. Well, 99 out of 100 people don't buy anything. But for many of them, it was their first time in a bona fide art gallery. Mm-hmm. And we'll have some exciting news to share very soon that we're going to have a presence in downtown Fargo as well. So we're all over the place, but it's all about revealing the joy of art, the joy of owning original art to as big an audience as we can.
Well, David, we'll have you back on when you do make the official Fargo announcement.
We'll break it right here.
Brandon, as an artist, what is a question that you are just really tired of getting asked? And what do you wish people would ask you instead?
Oh, wow. That is a... Yeah.
How long does it take?
Yeah. How long does it take?
2.5 more minutes on this interview.
Yeah. That's one of them. The two that I would be the most tired about is how long does it take and what does it mean? Those are the ones that I am the most tired of. And I think a lot of people might be confused and not understand why. Those are such frustrating questions to artists, but it's one of the reasons why artists are so tired is because it takes so much of us to be tuned in to creativity and then to have the skill and the energy to create and then put our out into the world. And then when, you know, that conversation between the viewer and the art comes, then having to also explain and teach about what it's about rather than the person having their own personal dialogue and understanding of it, what it makes them feel. That's more about what I would like to do and have an art or someone who looked at my art ask me a question like, oh man, that is hard. I don't know. I just don't know what I would want to be asked about my art. Britta, do you have anything that you think would be a good question for people to ask?
Thanks for doing my job for me.
Oh, goodness.
We've learned to tell people as abstract, what does that mean? What's it supposed to say? And the answer is, what do you think it means?
Right.
What does it say to you?
Yeah.
That's breaking the code.
Yeah. I mean, I get that question a lot, being like, what does it mean? And I have some very basic line representational. It's right in front of you. But all I can say is, well, can you put yourself into that painting and create a story for me? I mean, and then we have a conversation off of there. That's usually what I've learned to say instead of my own experience with my work, because I know my own experience, but I'm still striving to see what other people are feeling necessarily, to kind of poke back the question at them. So you don't just, you know, give them the answer. You want to make them conversate a little bit and not just shut it down.
So, Britta Anderson is one of the co-founders of the Tired Artists Fellowship, a sabbatical program for established artists. Britta, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brandon LaPlante is the other co-founder of the Tired Artists. Brandon, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And David Borlaug is the director of the Capitol Gallery, which is acting as the fiscal host for the fellowship. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You can find out more at BrittaAnderson.com, thecapitalgallery.com. You can follow Brandon on Instagram at Brandon.LaPlante. And you can read all about the fellowship and make a donation by searching Medium.com and The Tired Artists.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Well, there's the fanfare. That means it's time to welcome movie critic Matt O'Lean in studio. You have seen a couple films, so always around the Oscar time, we're doubling up on films here. And this first one you want to talk about looks pretty epic.
Boy, 1917, the World War I film directed by Sam Mendes, who, of course, won the Oscar 20 years ago for directing American Beauty.
That's 20 years old.
It's 20 years old, and he's gunning for his second directing nomination, or he actually got a nomination, but his second win. So this is a phenomenal motion picture. And from a marketing standpoint, they held this film back from general release till last week. And it was a stroke of genius because Star Wars had kind of run through about 3 weeks, and lo and behold, 1917 took the top spot at the box office last weekend because of the hype. Sometimes they do this in award seasons. They'll let the LA and New York critics see it in December, and then we here in the Midwest and the hinterlands get to see it on January 10th. So the big trick of this film is how they shot it. So two soldiers, British soldiers, are given orders by Colin Firth, who plays a high-ranking colonel or general, that they have to travel. We're not sure how long, but it's a bit of a hike to get to this division to call off an attack because it's a trap, and they're going to get massacred by the Germans. So one of the two soldiers who's sent, his brother is an officer in that division, so he's trying to save his brother as well. The two soldiers are played by Dean Charles Chapman, who was King Tommen in Game of Thrones, and George MacKay, who really gives a wonderful performance. So that's basically it. We follow them through their journey, through all kinds of hell, all kinds of trauma, to try, I'm not going to tell you what happens, try to get to the front lines to warn Benedict Cumberbatch, who's the colonel in charge, to call off the attack. And through this journey, there are literally a handful of edits in the whole film. It's basically like you're watching a theatrical play. The camera follows the two soldiers. Everything has to be on cue. I can't even imagine the rehearsal time for this. If one thing goes wrong, they have to start again. Most films are cut together, which does help with emotion sometimes, with, you know, dissolves and cutting from close up to close up. This time it's all a roving camera, kind of almost prowling after the two actors. And it really creates a phenomenal cinematic experience. Some people have complained the film isn't emotional enough for them because there's no cutting, no close-ups, not a lot of close-ups. I found it to be emotionally affecting. Along the way, we see four major stars: Colin Firth, Benedict Cumberbatch, look for Richard Madden from Game of Thrones, who played Robb Stark, Mark Strong. They're like little placeholders along the way as these two soldiers go along their way, meet these officers who are usually played by bigger stars than they are. But it's a phenomenal experience. Certainly will take its place as one of the great World War I films ever, along with All Quiet on the Western Front and Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas.
And then the other film that you saw, a very different kind of action told in a very different kind of way, Bombshell.
So I saw this a couple weeks ago, been kind of holding this one back. Got three Oscar nominations. Margot Robbie, who plays kind of a composite character. She's a very ambitious young journalist who wants to anchor at Fox News. And Charlize Theron plays Megyn Kelly in an uncanny performance.
I thought it was Megyn Kelly in the trailer.
It's a phenomenal piece of acting. She's got Megyn Kelly's mannerisms down. Megyn Kelly has tweeted her support of this performance, apparently, because she's seen it. And the third nomination was makeup and hairstyling, which you can understand that because we're at Fox News and, you know, appearance is a huge thing at Fox News. So John Lithgow plays Roger Ailes. The film takes place during the 2016 presidential campaign, when Ailes was eventually accused of sexual harassment by Gretchen Carlson, who's played by Nicole Kidman. And she kind of has that Minnesota accent down. Gretchen Carlson, of course, from the Twin Cities. So that's what the film's about. I wanted it to be a little deeper. The performances are great, but I have a feeling that director Jay Roach, I just wanted a little bit more gravitas. It almost feels like it's a two-hour soap opera. There are some interesting editing techniques. The film starts with Charlize Theron talking to the audience. Here's what you're about to see. So there are some interesting, you know, breaking the fourth wall techniques that are used. And each character has that moment in the film to kind of break the fourth wall, whether it's Megyn Kelly or Gretchen Carlson or Margot Robbie as the composite character. But what really drives this film are the three performances by the three female stars I mentioned. And Charlize Theron is right at the top of that. So it's a watchable film. It's interesting to go behind the scenes as to what happened at Fox News, how Roger Ailes' behavior was covered up over the years. What I found unrealistic in a couple of the parts is there's a point in the film where kind of the lid is off and Gretchen Carlson has filed her suit and she's looking for other women to step forward. And of course, they're hesitant at first. And there's a couple scenes where Megyn Kelly, Charlize Theron, is kind of walking through the newsroom asking women if they were harassed. I can't believe she would have done that in kind of an open newsroom way. Mm. That's more of a private conversation. I could be wrong, but that seemed a little unrealistic to me. But go to see it for the performances. That's the big thing.
We've been in the movies with Matt O'Lean. That's it for the weekend edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday during our 3 o'clock Central time slot, we honor the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and hear from Jeff Stone, who will be delivering the keynote address at an observance in Bismarck. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.